So the W and the Z bosons are massive. And you're used to thinking about gauge bosons as being massless, like the photon. And it's a problem if they have a mass. Not a problem, but something to be solved. Another thing about the W and the Z is that they have chiral couplings to fermions. So what I mean by that, of course, is that they have different couplings to left-handed and right-handed spinners. All right. Both of these things are an issue because it turns out that both of them naively are inconsistent with gauge theory, with gauge invariance, and also with renormalizability. And I told you before, we want to build the theory upon the principles of gauge invariance and renormalizability, so it might look like we're cooked, but so we need to work on how to get around this. All right. So. Before we get into the standard model, we're going to consider kind of a toy standard model-like theory. Let's see. We're going to consider a QED-like theory. With a massive photon. A mu. So here's the Lagrangian. We have minus a quarter f mu nu. And then let me put in a mass term for the photon. So a mass term would look like this, 1/2, and then the mass squared, and then we have a mu. And then we have the fermion part. So that's psi bar I d slash minus the mass psi. All right. So f mu nu is just the usual field strength tensor. And d mu is the covariant derivative. So I have d mu plus I. And I want to think about a theory where the gauge boson has a different coupling to left-handed and right-handed fields, because that will be similar to the standard model. So if it was QED, I would just write E times A mu, but that just has the same coupling for left and right-handed fields, so that's not what I want. So what I need is something like this, G left, so this is the coupling constant for left-handed fields, times a left-handed projection operator, plus G right, times a right-handed projection operator, and then A mu, like this. It does. Yeah, so it's kind of, so what I'm trying to do is build a gauge theory that does have a mass. And so you might say, I'm an idiot for trying to do this because obviously it doesn't work, right? But let's see what goes wrong exactly. All right. And so let me just write down what are the gauge transformations, just to remind you. So A mu will transform like this. I have A mu plus d mu times a function alpha of x. And then the fermion fields also transform. But the left and right-handed fields transform differently. So I have to write it like this. It goes like e to the minus I g left or g right times alpha of x acting on psi left or psi right. So the left and right-handed parts transform independently under the gauge transformation, and it depends on the couplings. Let me also write down, of course, you have the projection operators. It is 1 minus plus gamma 5 over 2. And the left and right-handed spinners are just the projection operators acting on the full four-component Dirac spinner. OK. Then you can ask, how do these terms transform under gauge invariance? And as you pointed out, the mass term is not invariant. And it's trivial to see that. So you can just imagine, how does the mass term for A transform? It goes to A mu. But then there's some other stuff, which is 2 times A mu, E mu times alpha, and then plus D mu alpha squared. OK, so that's not invariant. That violates the gauge symmetry. The mass term for psi also violates the gauge symmetry. So if I write psi bar psi, which is, I can write that as psi left times psi right plus psi bar right times psi left. Now, how does this transform under the gauge symmetry? Well, so both of these two fields transform differently. So I have e to the I g left minus g right psi bar times alpha, psi bar left, psi right, plus e to the minus I g left minus g right, psi bar right, psi left. So this is also not invariant. So it's not equal to psi bar psi. All right. The other term, the covariant derivative term, maybe it's not obvious, but you can check. Psi bar d slash psi is invariant, so this will transform to itself. So it's the two mass terms that break the gauge symmetry, the mass term for the fermion and the mass term for the gauge boson. All right. So again, you might say, well, why should I have thought of this as a gauge theory at all, since it doesn't have gauge invariance? So let's just say maybe it's not a gauge theory. Is there anything else that goes wrong? OK, so all right, what else goes wrong? So it turns out the theory is also non-renormalizable. All right, so this is bad. How can we see this? So let's start by considering the Feynman propagator for the photon. So I just remind you what that is. So I'll write it as d, and then it has two Lorentz indices, mu and nu, x comma y. And the Feynman propagator is just the time-ordered product of the two fields. In this case, the fields are a mu of x and then a nu of y. All right? And then you take the vacuum expectation value. If you have a massless photon, the Fourier transform of the Feynman propagator is, you would write it as d mu nu momentum k, and that's equal to minus I eta mu nu over k squared plus I epsilon. Right? This looks familiar? Yeah, okay. So how do we get this? This will be really basic, but let's just review it, because then we'll go to the massive case in a second. So the way you can compute the propagator you can use the mode expansion. For the fields. So here's the mode expansion. A mu of x is an integral over k and then I have a sum over the polarizations I and there's a 1 over 2 times the energy and then I have the polarization vector epsilon I sub mu momentum k annihilation operator e to the I k dot x and then I have the complex conjugate of everything I just wrote down all right. Now I can compute this propagator just by plugging this into here and evaluating it. All right, so I think this is probably your view. So you just do d3k over 2 pi cubed 1 over 2 ek. D3k prime over 2 pi cubed 1 over 2 e k prime. Then I have to sum over the two polarization vectors. So I'll sum over I and j. Then I have an epsilon mu I of k and epsilon j of nu of k prime. And then I have the expectation value of a sub k I, a sub j k prime, dagger, like this. And then I have e to the minus k dot x minus k prime dot y. OK, I think that's it. There's only one term, because this is the only expectation value that gives you a non-zero answer. And when you take this expectation value, you probably know you can just commute these two things and say that the annihilation operator kills the vacuum. And then you're just left with 2 times the energy, Ek, times 2 pi cubed times delta 3 of k minus k prime, like this. Then you use this delta function to evaluate one of these integrals. And the end result is d3k over 2 pi cubed 1 over 2 ek. You have a sum over the polarization vectors, e mu I k e nu I of k star. And then you have e to the minus I k of x minus y. All right. Then, for a massless photon, you can replace this by minus I eta mu nu. All right. So the only thing we need to figure out for the case of a massive photon is what is the sum over polarization vectors? Basically, we want to replace minus eta mu nu with something. And then we just plug it in to the same expression we had before for the Feynman propagator. So for a massive photon, it has three polarizations instead of two. And let's just start by considering the photon at rest. The photons at rest, the polarization vectors are just vectors that point in some direction in space, right? X, Y, and Z. And so I can choose the basis of polarization vectors to just be unit vectors, X, Y, Z. So I've got three polarization vectors. We would have E1 sub mu, which is, let's say, in the x direction. We would have E2 sub mu, which, let's say, points in the y direction. And E3 sub mu, which just points in the z direction like this. And we can put them together. So the sum over polarization vectors of E mu I at momentum 0, E I nu momentum 0 star, that would just be equal to the matrix 0, 1, 1, 1. So that's what it is. Now, okay, we don't want momentum zero, we want momentum k. So we just need to boost to another frame to get the answer for arbitrary momentum. So now let's boost. So we'll have momentum k mu, which is E sub k, 0, 0, and then the 3 vector k. So we're just boosting along the z direction. The boost matrix is, so you do lambda, which is gamma, 0, 0, beta gamma, 0, 0, beta gamma, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, gamma. And then gamma is just the energy divided by the mass. And beta is just the three momentum divided by the energy. All right. So now let's just boost this matrix. So what we want is epsilon mu I of k, epsilon I nu of k, and then star. Is this equal to lambda acting on this? 0, 1, 1, 1 times lambda. And if you just evaluate this matrix, what you get is k squared. This is the three momentum squared. 0, 0, e, k times the three momentum k. 0, 0, E k times the three momentum k, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, and you have 0, 0, and then E k squared. And then 1 over ma squared. And you can rewrite this in terms of Lorentz tensors as minus eta mu nu plus k mu k nu divided by ma squared. Okay, so that's the answer. When you sum over polarization vectors for a massive photon, you get the minus 8 mu nu, which is the mass, same thing as a massless case, plus another term, which is k mu k nu divided by ma squared. So let's just write down the rules. So when you sum over polarizations, you get 8 mu nu minus 8 mu nu for a massless photon. And when you sum over polarizations for a massive photon, or the W of the Z, you get minus 8 mu nu plus k mu k nu divided by the mass of the boson squared. So if you're doing this, for example, for the Z, you would have, this would be the momentum of the Z, and this would be, for example, mz squared. All right. Okay, now we have all we need to write down the propagator for a massive photon. So the Fourier transform of the Feynman propagator would just be minus I over k squared. Now, of course, the pole is not at 0, but it's at the mass squared. And there's a plus I epsilon as usual. And then instead of having eta mu nu, we have eta mu nu minus k mu k nu divided by ma squared. Okay, so there we go. Now, the reason I went through this exercise is that the behavior of the propagator has a very different dependence on k than the photon propagator. Here, the photon propagator will go to 0 as k squared goes to infinity, but this propagator doesn't, right? Because you have k in the numerator and k in the denominator. So that's the important thing that's going to mess everything up. Let me just remind you what the story is for QED, right? QED, when you start to calculate things in one loop, you get infinities, right? You have divergences. And what you do is you regulate those divergences, and then you reabsorb them into the parameters of the theory, right? So in QED, you have divergences. In the two-point and three-point functions. So by that, I just mean like a diagram like this, two-point function, and the three-point function would be like this. So these things diverge, have divergences. And then you absorb those divergences into, for example, the mass of the electron or the coupling constant of the photon. So you can absorb, in fact, all divergences into the renormalized parameters of the theory. Such as, you know, the mass of the electron and also the coupling constant. All right. But the case of the massive photon doesn't work so simply. All right. So let's consider the four-point function. In the massive QCD theory, sorry, QED theory, QED-like theory. All right, so what we're going to do is scattering. And we're going to consider the one-loop diagram like this. So we have a fermion, scattering with a fermion. All right. And if we're doing this in QED, normal QED, there'd be no divergence. Because there's no new divergences that should crop up, which we'd have to get rid of. Well, let's evaluate this diagram. Well, we're not really going to evaluate. Let's just do like a, see how divergent it is. All right. So we have to do some loop integral over the momentum in the loop. Let's just call that K. So K is some momentum flowing around the loop. And I just want to see how it diverges. And so I'm just going to neglect all the other momenta and masses that are entering in here. So I have an integral over momentum, d4k over 2 pi to the fourth. All right, so every fermion propagator goes like k slash over k squared. I can just write that as 1 over k slash. That's like a heuristic way to write it. And since I have two of those for two fermion propagators here, which are carrying this momentum, I'll just square it. And now I have the photon propagators here. Now again, I'm just going to consider the leading term with k. And so I only need to consider this term and the k squared here. So it looks something like k mu k nu over k squared. And then I have two of those propagators. So I'll just square it. Of course, I'm being kind of heuristic with the Lorentz indices, so don't worry about that part. All right, now I just want to see how divergent it is. So this is d to the fourth. This is 1 over, sorry, this is k to the fourth. This is 1 over k squared. And this is like 1. So I'm left with something that diverges like k squared as k goes to infinity. And so if I imagine cutting off the integral with some cutoff lambda, this would go like lambda squared, where lambda is the momentum cutoff. So it is divergent. That's bad. Actually, I think it's, I haven't actually calculated, but I think it's not as divergent as this. Because there's actually two diagrams you should include. One is that one. And then the other one looks like this. This diagram, you have k going around like this. And this diagram is the same, except now, if k is going this way here, k is also going the same way over here. And so k will flip sign from one diagram to the other. And so this divergence, I think, will cancel out. But you'll still be left with a smaller divergence. It'll be log divergent. So let me write it as log of the cutoff squared. But the dimensions will be the same. You'll end up getting the mass in front, like this. And then, well, we have four interactions. And so let me just write g to the fourth here. OK. So, well, don't worry about too much about this part. But the key point is that it's divergence. Log divergence is still a divergence. And so we need to renormalize that. So what you need to do is try to absorb it into some counterterm. But of course, you can't reabsorb this into a counter term for charge or the mass or the wave function because it comes into only the four-point function. So you need to introduce a new term into the Lagrangian to absorb this. So you need to introduce a dimension 6 operator which is psi bar psi and psi bar psi just to absorb the divergence in this diagram. But now if you introduce the counter term, there's no reason why you shouldn't have had this interaction in the theory itself, right? I shouldn't have written down just QED without this operator. It's there. And so I should include this in the theory. So what you do is you absorb into an interaction, just call it Lint, which is VC, some coupling constant, times psi bar psi, psi bar psi. Now the problem with this is now that the theory is very clearly non-normalizable, right? The idea of renormalization is to absorb divergences into the parameters, but once you've measured the parameters, you can calculate anything. Here we can calculate nothing, because whatever you want to compute, it depends on what you choose for these parameters. So let me just give you an example. Let's just say you wanted to compute psi, psi to psi, psi scattering, the 2-to-2 scattering process. And if you just wanted to do it at tree level, what you do is you would do this diagram here, and then you would do the one like this. And in QED, that's all you would need to compute, but now we need to include the contribution from this diagram too. It would look like this, right? We don't know what this coupling is. We know what the charge is, but we don't know what this coupling is. What you do is you'd fix the coupling to satisfy whatever experimental constraint you had on this process. Okay. So it's not predictive. And the problem just doesn't stop here at dimension 6, but higher point functions also have the same issue. So there's no predictivity. Okay. Oh, so it's dimension 6 just because it's, so what you would do is look at the external states. In the external states, you have four fermion fields. And so to form an operator that has four fermion fields, it has to be dimension 6. No, it doesn't have anything to do with the divergence. It's just that you have a divergence in a particular endpoint function. And so the argument is here it's just a four-point function. And so you need an operator that can reproduce a four-point function. Any other questions on this argument? So is it clear kind of what goes wrong with the massive vector theory? It's not just an issue of gauge invariance, but you lose predictive power because the theory is non-normalizable.
Can we be sure that we don't have a scalar field like lingering around somewhere because we have a vector field that is massive? How do we know that it really is spin one and has no spin normal? Because there are 4 degrees of freedom in 4 degrees.
No, it still has 3 degrees of freedom.
Yeah, but usually we argue that there are only two electricities by using gauge invariance or something like this, but here we don't have anything, right? It's just a massive theory.
Oh, why don't you have 4 degrees of freedom?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. So there's, I mean, so it's spin one, so you know that there's only three spin states. And if you write it as a four component vector, it obscures that fact a little bit, but it still is true regardless. Okay. So I guess another way to say it is that in the massless case, there's two unphysical polarizations, the time-like one and the longitudinal one. Here, the time-like polarization for the massive photon is still unphysical, but now you just have the longitudinal polarization, which is fine. Any other questions on this? So the idea is to try to solve these problems using an idea called spontaneous symmetry breaking. And you've seen that bad things happen when you break a gauge symmetry by hand explicitly. So when you put in terms in the Lagrangian that violate the symmetry, you get sometimes all sorts of undesired consequences in your theory. But a theory can, the symmetry can be broken even if, oops, the Lagrangian preserves the symmetry. Probably the most famous example is the example of ferromagnetism. That's a case where the symmetry is broken. In that case, it's rotational invariance, even though the Lagrangian itself has rotational invariance, right? So that's an example. And so the idea is that the ground state of the theory ground state with broken symmetry has less energy than a state with unbroken symmetry. For ferromagnetism, it's energetically favorable for all of the spins to all align with one another. And so they're picking out a preferred direction where they're all pointing in the same direction. It's energetically favorable compared to the situation where all the spins are just randomized. So that's the example of what I'm talking about. All right, so let's just see how this works. So let's say let U be a symmetry. That leaves a Hamiltonian invariant. So we have H goes to U, H U dagger, and this is just equal to H. So it's invariant under some symmetry transformation. And now we'll say let two states, A and B, be related under the symmetry transformation. So that just means that U acting on A turns into a state B. Or you could express the same thing in terms of creation and annihilation operators. You would say that the state A is equal to some creation operator acting on the vacuum, and the state B is some other creation operator acting on the vacuum. And in that case, the creation operators have to be related to each other by the symmetry transformation. So we must have U acting on the creation operator for A, U dagger has to be equal to B dagger. All right, so let's just check that this holds. So we have U acting on A dagger, acting on the state A is U times A dagger the vacuum. Let's insert U dagger U. All right, and so this is equal to B. And this, well, the usual assumption would be is that the vacuum itself is invariant under the symmetry transformation. So this is equal to just the vacuum again if the vacuum is invariant. So if that's the case, then this is just equal to AB dagger acting on the vacuum, which is just equal to B. All right. But if you violate this assumption where the vacuum is not invariant under the symmetry, it's not the case anymore. You could also think about the energies. So you would say A and B have the same energy. So the spectra of states is the same for both states A and B. And so you can see that very easily. You would just say the energy of A is just the expectation value of the Hamiltonian with respect to state A. And so that's just equal to B times U times H, and then U dagger, times B. And since this is just equal to H, this is just equal to B, Hamiltonian B, which is just equal to EB. All right. So if all this holds, and it requires that the vacuum is invariant under the symmetry, then the spectrum of states in the theory respects the symmetry. If the ground state violates the symmetry, the symmetry will not be manifest. Spectrum. Okay. Yeah, so in the case that we're interested in, the symmetry will be the gauge symmetry. And so in that case, what you would say is that the mass of the states, the mass of the gauge boson should be zero. That would manifest the symmetry. But now we're thinking about cases where the gauge boson has a mass, and so that seems like it violates the symmetry. So the symmetry is not manifest. You could also think about other kinds of symmetries. Let's say you had different kinds of particles that were related under a symmetry. And we'll see that when we talk about QCD and bound states of QCD. But so you can have different states, different mesons, let's say, which are related under the symmetry. But because there's a symmetry, the masses of those states should be the same. And if the symmetry is broken, the masses will be different. So that's another kind of example. All right. And then I just want to make one other point. Even though the symmetry is not respected with respect to the spectrum, there's still information that the symmetry was there to begin with. Because a theory which has a broken symmetry is very different than a theory which had no symmetry at all. As we'll see, as you saw, the theory where the symmetry was just explicitly broken has all kinds of problems. But the theory where the symmetry is broken spontaneously will have very special relations among the parameters of the theory to solve these problems. All right, so we're going to see how this works. We're going to start with a very simple example, which is, let's say we have the case of a discrete symmetry. So we'll have a theory with a real vector field. Phi with a Z2 symmetry. That just means that the theory is invariant if you set phi to minus phi. So here's the Lagrangian. You have a 1/2 d mu phi squared. We have a mass term, 1/2 mu squared. Phi squared, and then we have a cubic term, lambda over 4, phi to the fourth. Of course, there's no term proportional to phi. There's no term proportional to phi cubed. That would violate the symmetry, so we don't want that. We're assuming that the theory has the symmetry. Okay, here we go. Now we can think about, okay, what's the Hamiltonian? Since we want to think about what's the ground state, we want to think about what's the lowest energy state. The Hamiltonian is just 1/2 phi dot squared plus 1/2 times the gradient of phi squared. And then we have the potential, which I write as V like this, of phi. And the potential is just 1/2 mu squared phi squared. And then plus 1, lambda over 4, phi to the fourth. All right. And so now I just want to think about what should phi be to minimize the Hamiltonian. That would be the ground state. Phi dot squared and the gradient of phi squared are always positive. So if I have a time-dependent phi or a phi with a gradient, that's always going to increase the Hamiltonian. So it's going to increase the energy. So the minimum energy case will be where phi is just a constant. So that means phi dot is equal to 0, and the gradient of phi is equal to 0. OK. So these terms are both 0. And so the minimum energy just comes from minimizing the potential. Where does the potential have a minimum? Another thing, we want to have lambda greater than 0. Otherwise, the Hamiltonian is unbounded from below. You can just go to arbitrarily large values of phi, and the energy can just be increased indefinitely. That would be bad. So we don't want the Hamiltonian to be unbounded from below. But mu squared can have either sign. I'm thinking of mu squared just as a parameter, not as some real number squared. So mu squared itself can be positive or negative. And the potential looks different in the two cases. So now let's think about the case where mu squared is positive. The potential just looks like this. All right. So the minimum in this case is obviously 0. Or if mu squared is negative, the potential looks different. The curvature of the potential has the opposite sign, close to the origin. But then the quartic term ends up winning at large values of phi, and so it will look like this. This is a plot of phi, v versus phi, and this is for mu squared less than 0. So the minimum of the potential is, of course, not at 0, but it's at some non-zero value, which I'll just call v, and you can also have at minus v. So this is where the potential is minimized here. So the minimum is at phi is equal to v. All right. Oops. Oh, that's it. So in the first case, where mu squared is positive, the vacuum value of the field is 0, because that's where the energy is minimized. And so I'd write the vacuum expectation value of phi should be equal to 0. And this is the case where the symmetry is unbroken. And then the other case, where mu squared is less than 0, the vacuum has a value of phi, which is non-zero. And so if I take the vacuum expectation value of the field, it's just equal to some number v. So v is called the vacuum expectation value. Or called VEV for short. All right, so we can figure out what the VEV should be. All you need to do is minimize the potential. So what you want to say is that the derivative of the potential with respect to phi evaluated at the VEV should be equal to 0. So I get, let's see. So the first term just gives me mu squared times v. And the second term will give me lambda times v cubed. And so I can solve for v, and it's just equal to the square root of minus mu squared over lambda. Remember, mu squared is negative, so minus mu squared will be positive. And it can have either sign. I can have it be plus or minus. All right. Let's see. All right, so we found the VEV. What next? Next, we want to think about the spectrum of physical states. So physical states are small oscillations about the vacuum. So I don't want to think about phi as being a small oscillation away from zero, because the vacuum is over here. So it makes more sense to shift phi to be a small oscillation around the VEV. So let's just shift the field. So we'll call that, so we'll let phi be equal to the VEV plus some shifted field phi prime. And I'm just going to consider the case where V is greater than 0. So it has the positive sign there. It doesn't matter. So now what's the Lagrangian? It's equal to 1 half d mu phi prime. We have a minus 1 half mu squared times V plus phi prime squared minus 1 quarter lambda V plus phi prime to the fourth. OK, and if I expand everything out, here's what I get. I get a 1 half d mu phi prime squared. I get a minus mu squared times phi squared. I get a minus lambda V phi prime. Oops, this is a prime. Cubed, and I get a minus lambda over fourth phi prime to the fourth. So this is the theory in terms of the shifted field phi prime. And what you'd say is, if you just looked at this theory, it doesn't seem to have any remnant of the original symmetry. There's no symmetry where you set phi prime equal to minus phi prime. Because you have this cubic term here. It doesn't satisfy the symmetry. Did I make an error? There's no linear term. The linear term goes away because the first derivative at the minimum is equal to 0. So there's no linear term. It ends up canceling out. Yeah. Right. So you would, I'm not sure if this will answer your question, but what you would do is you start with expanding around the vacuum like this, and this is the field that you would do the mode expansion on, phi prime. Does that answer your question?
Why do we have to assume that it's a small
oscillation? That's what I want. Let's see. Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how to answer that. It's kind of the usual thing that you do. You think about particle states as small perturbations on the vacuum. So this is probably unsatisfactory.
So, but in this step, we haven't assumed anything. We haven't neglected any terms, right? I mean, we haven't assumed that phi prime to the power of 4 or whatever is small to begin with.
Yeah, you haven't assumed anything about that. It's really just an approximation. Sorry, not approximation, but it more comes into the where you try to set up quantum field theory. You would treat your you quantize the fields, the part of the field that that's corresponds to a small perturbation around the vacuum. So that's all. Yeah. What do you mean the other vacuum states?
Because when an oscillation is huge, then it will reach another vacuum.
Yeah, in principle it could. Yeah.
So in this case, just to say we don't need to
They could be right. I don't know. Oh, I'm out of time. Let me just finish this really quick. I'm almost done. I already mentioned, phi prime doesn't have the original symmetry. Another thing to mention, the mass of phi prime is this term. So you would say the mass of phi prime squared. If you want to canonically normalize the mass term, they should have a factor of 1/2. So I should have a 2 here. It's minus 2 mu squared is the mass squared of phi prime. If you just wrote down this Lagrangian, you would say that there is no symmetry, right? So how do you know that there should have been a symmetry to start with? Well, it's reflected in the fact that the cubic term, which violates the symmetry, is not a totally independent coupling constant, but is actually determined in terms of the other parameters of the theory, right? Because if you knew what the quartic coupling was, and you knew what the mass term was, then you know what the VEV is, and then you know what the quartic is, you can predict what the cubic term is. And so the fact that you had a symmetry to begin with that was broken is reflected in a relation between the parameters of the theory, which turns out to be very important for solving these issues of renormalizability. The problematic divergences end up canceling out because of this relation between parameters. OK. So yeah?
The mass of the field in this case turns out to be positive because you're expanding around the true vacuum.
Yeah.
But if you were naive and you could compare it, like try to measure this mass of the old vacuum, it would be a negative, like imaginary mass or whatever.
So if you try to expand. Yeah, that's right. So if you try to expand around this vacuum, you'll run into a problem. You'll have like a tachyon.
Would you detect it to be a tachyon?
No. So I mean, no.
What is a tachyon?
Tachyon just means that the mass squared is negative. So if you plug it into I don't know. It would look like if you plug it into theory of special relativity, it looks like something's going faster than light. I'd say. In my opinion, tachyons are really just a symptom that you're expanding around the wrong vacuum. So it tells you that the vacuum is actually not stable, and so it should decay somehow to the lowest energy state, which is this.
But can you find a vacuum experiment?
Can you find what's the true vacuum?
Right.
So there's no way to, I'd say, measure the vacuum, unless you want to talk about measuring the cosmological constant. There's no way to measure the vacuum necessarily. Only you can measure fluctuations around the vacuum, which are particle states.
Or
you should have plugged in your wires, I think. Yeah?
So, like, to avoid the entire interstitial issue of, like, what is part of the vision, if I have this potential, are my correlation functions, like, vanishing outside of, like, the maximum person?
You're talking about expanding around this vacuum? Yeah, there's no problem with that. There's nothing that, but I wouldn't know how to compute the correlation functions expanding around something which wasn't actually the vacuum. So if I wanted to expand around some other point, I actually not even know how to compute it. But if you just do the normal thing and expand around the actual vacuum, there's no problem with exactly what you said. Any other questions?
Can you just more explicit how this new redefinition cures the perfect problem?
Yeah, we'll get there. So this is just the discrete case. When we were talking about the massive photon case, it will have to get back to the idea of a gauge symmetry that's spontaneously broken. So you have to wait till next time.
How do we do a renormalization? Like, well, the
top link to 5 prime 3 and the top link to 5 prime square be like 6 or something? The ratio?
Yeah, that's right.
Also, like after renormalization, it was giving similar forms, but with a.
Oh, yeah. That's right. So even if you renormalize the theory, the relations between the parameters will still hold, such that the issues are always solved.
Also, but after renormalization, we control lambda and mu. We don't change the v.
No, you can also change v. So if you think about the original theory, you're changing, you would renormalize, let's say, the mu squared and lambda. And so if you change those, you're affecting where the actual minimum is. But another way to think about it is renormalization and divergences are really a problem with not the vacuum, but with the high energy behavior of the theory. The high energy behavior of the theory doesn't care about where the vacuum is necessarily, right? So if you're, okay. So that's kind of a clue that if you started with a theory, which is obviously renormalizable, then there's nothing that's going to change through spontaneous symmetry breaking, even though it appears that you might run into problems.
But like technically, if you want to do a renormalization, we will do it with the unbroken one, or we just do it with like the one we shift the.
It depends on the context. So I'm not sure there's a right or a wrong way to do it.
If we do it with this one, like the five prime one, we might run into trouble that's like at high energy your wall goes to another vacuum.
So it depends what you mean by at high energy. So in principle, there are issues where if you have a high energy density, then the symmetry can get restored due to additional corrections to the potential. So there are issues like this. So not sure if that's exactly what you're asking about. But if you're only interested in computing the divergences, then it really doesn't matter at all that the symmetry is broken. You could just do the calculation with the unbroken symmetry case.
Okay.